Content warning. Today's episode refers to death, suffering, and some rather graphic descriptions of medical situations, as well as extremely painful things, infection, viruses, and an incredibly nasty person who seems to be an abusive husband.
Hey, hey, folks. Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us, won't you, for Chapter 9 of Catch-22 by Joseph Heller.
Major. Sorry, the title makes me laugh.
Yes, that is the title that we will be reading this week. Major.
Yes, or major four. Four major.
I'm getting it all out of the way because I believe you said at the end of the last episode you want to catalog how many times I will have to say major in the reading of this chapter.
It's going to be a lot. A lot. So many majors.
It will be a major endeavor.
Hey, that's terrible. Yes. Yes, it will. So, yes. I apologize if I sound a bit funny. It's, I had a bit of a sick week.
Recovering.
And I'm still feeling a bit sniffy, cloggy, blah. But it's okay. It will get better. As one does, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Look, most virals that are not the virus, your body has a decent chance of mostly recovering. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're good.
Just got to put the right things in your system and get plenty of rest.
And hope that your genetics didn't decide to just not play ball, which does happen. So yes, most people will recover from a virus with adequate rest, but then there's a fraction that absolutely do not. And that's not including viruses that are particularly nasty. So yes, hence sniffling occasionally. So I apologize. I will try and not sniffle too much.
That's also why she'll be a little less energetic than usual, but I'm sure the chapter and just the confusion of Catch-22 will get you paying attention and interjecting and
for sure. Oh, so much. How are you doing, Dave?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm a little stiff, a little tired, a little hungry. Just need a top up in probably every aspect of my life, just a little top up.
Oh yeah,
well, I'm just a little under that line across the board. Partly my own fault. I had a day with a good friend yesterday where we filled our bodies with awful food and awful drink.
I think I know who you visited, but yes.
Yeah. So I'm pushing 40, and really, I shouldn't be putting my body through this at this point, but I don't think I have much longer where I can actually do it without grave consequences.
No pun intended. But yes.
So, I basically have a grease and sugar hangover.
I see. Yes, no, those can be pretty rough. It's been a while since I've had one of those, mainly.
Well, that's the thing, like, I've never been much of a drinker. I do enjoy one on occasion. So I think I've had one alcohol hangover in my life. But thanks to my sweet tooth and my diet and just my love of bad food, I've had plenty of sugar hangovers
in my life. I'd like to say there's no such thing as bad food. There's food that is maybe nutritionally unbalanced and should not be consumed in excess. But there's no such thing as bad food.
That's a nice way of putting it.
The thing is, for one person, is bad food or good food, is bad food or good food for another person. So I guess the way to phrase it is, for me, for my body, excess refined and processed foods of high caloric but low nutritional value.
Look, no. Medical professional is going to recommend any of their patients actually eat KFC.
You'd be surprised. There are a handful of conditions where it's actually a thing.
Excess grease needed?
Yes, where they need to consume ridiculous caloric intake, and it has to be particularly fatty, salty things. We're talking some severe metabolic disorders usually, or even occasionally there are eating disorders where as long as they're eating something and they need to gain weight.
I did make
So
that
yeah.
joke to Kenneth yesterday. He's the friend I went to see, because we were both feeling really awful after it. And I'm
As you
like,
do.
hey, remember when we were in our 20s and we had a metabolism?
Everyone does, but yes, I'm with you. It's a confronting situation when you go, oh, my body's not going to be able to do that. So any of our younger listeners,
Enjoy it.
eventually, yeah, well, enjoy it, but also eventually your body does give, and it does, your body does respond to what you're contributing to it now. There will be long-term
Well,
consequences.
and here's the thing. It's not that I won't be able to do this once I get into my 40s. It's just that already there is a quite dear recovery time, and I think that's just going to get worse as I
You pay,
age.
I think the most straightforward way to see your body is that depend I mean you have a baseline, you have you, each body is different, there's that anyway, but you end up paying I think I might have used this expression before, but I'll use it again. It's like having a credit card bill or a debt, and you at the moment you have engaged in a purchase and you have that temporary yay, I've got the thing. And then if things bring you that dopamine rush, well, you know, I have paid that bill or I have done the thing or I have purchased the whatever, but you still have to pay off that debt. And there's also a tax, like there's a what's it called? It's indexed, so it comes at a interest rate that comes on top of it. So
And
you pay for things.
I do like in this metaphor also the idea that, yeah, like good diet, good sleep, good exercise can make sure there's money in your account when
Yes,
you go
so
purchase these
you
items.
try your best. It's the same way that someone, if you get a okay, so say you catch a virus, topical, and you have, I know, it's never not going to be topical in the next foreseeable future, but say you catch a virus, and it having a healthy baseline being that you don't have any significant blood pressure issues, you've got a well responding immune system, but not excessively responding immune system. You have sufficient energy in your body in terms of like you've got enough fat storage that your body can draw on if you can't consume food. You are well hydrated. Your kidneys work. You know, different parts of your body are functioning optimally for you, or at least within an optimal range. It doesn't mean you're gonna be like absolutely perfect and recover and everything will be fine and no, but it gives you slightly better odds. Like your odds are going to be slightly better compared to someone who maybe, you know, has an inflammatory disorder or has allergies or has cholesterol problems or whatever. Like these things that are not maybe not optimal. Maybe your kidney isn't working as well. Again, doesn't make you a bad person, is not a judgment on you as a person at all. It's just that's the state that you're in.
You
It
know,
can make the difference.
it reminds me of I've heard it said, this is anecdotally I read online about how folks who get like their yearly flu vaccine for whatever strain is, you know, popular and out there. Popular is probably the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
The one that's most likely to occur.
They talk about, you know, oh yeah, I still get the flu usually, but like it knocks me out for 24 hours instead of a week.
The thing with I've had this conversation with someone recently, which was the flu vaccine. People think that it gives them the flu. It doesn't actually give you the flu. It's more a the probability of being exposed to the flu is higher when you're going to get your vaccine because it is usually flu season when you get your flu vaccine. But also, you will have an immune response, and some people, a handful of people, are going to have a fairly extreme immune response, and it's going to feel terrible. But you might feel terrible for 2 days versus, you know, potentially months of recovering. And then if you catch the flu, you if it's a flu that is of the strains that were predicted, you are less likely to have a severe outcome, which you know, hospitalization or death. So it's all about improving the odds, banking a little bit of health dosh, I guess, is the way to put it. It's like you're investing a little bit in your health. The same way that people, you know, take multivitamins because they might have a deficiency. Unless you have a deficiency, having those multivitamins, you've got expensive pee. So it's not going to do anything. But if you have a deficiency, and if you're one of the lucky people, like most people, and you absorb from these multivitamins, then that can help, you know, balance out anything that's maybe not being covered by your diet, or if you have some sort of deficiency or inability to absorb. So we're constantly playing this. We're constantly trying our best to optimize our situation. I mean, not everyone can do this. Not everyone is able to emotionally, mentally, or physically do this, or financially do this. But ideally, you work towards what you can do within the resources that you have available to you. Yeah. So having, we know, a good night's sleep. A good night's sleep is a key restorative thing. It's great. It's when your tissue repairs and your body gets a chance to recover. However, there's going to be people who've got insomnia, or people who are have narcolepsy, or people who've got... So whenever we try and compare health, that's when we go and get ourselves into a mess and a tangled web. But we can only gauge by ourselves. Like you were saying, you're slightly below your normal baseline, where you'd like to be across the board. But you immediately identify, well, I know what's helped me. I know what's contributed to that, and I know what's going to help me return to that baseline that I want to be at. And that's all you can really ask of any human being, is to give it a shot, to try, and to be, I guess, compassionate towards everyone. Has their off days. Not everyone can, you know. I think it's actually probably harder for someone who has never had a bad health day in their life to then suddenly be confronted by like a serious illness or a hospitalization, or the idea of hospitalization, that it could happen to them. You know, I've never broken a bone in my life, but now suddenly I have osteoporosis and everything's breaking. I don't understand. It's like, genetics.
My mom got chicken pox in her 50s.
Oh gosh, that would have been terrible.
I remember it being quite an ordeal.
Yes, no, I remember that was going on. That was rough. Oof. Yeah, I know that my brother, when he got it in his 30s, that was not good. Like he had a rough time of it.
But there's a reason why parents try and get their kids infected as early as possible.
I will say, if you can get the chickenpox vaccine, get the chickenpox vaccine.
That's something I only learned about recently.
Yeah, that's another one. That's one of those vaccines that actually that's one of those vaccines that's actually been around for a long time. It's just that it's not on many countries' obligatory vaccination lists and other things. And it's also something that's, because it just came out, I think, in 1996, 94, 96, something like that. So it became available, and I know in some systems it's not even on the list. In Australia it is. You need 2 doses.
For me, possibly like you as well, I was 2 or 3 and I got it.
Yeah, I got it when I was, I would have been 7 or 8, and it was not great. And the problem with chickenpox is once you've got it, it's in your system and it's dormant. And if you're really unlucky, you're a person who can get it again.
I know it's a form of, it's shingles basically, right?
Well, shingles is essentially a reactivated version of chickenpox that attacks particularly your nerves. And it's not good, because that can happen. And then what usually happens in about, I can't remember, that there's a large proportion of people who get shingles. So the sequence is, people who have chickenpox have had chickenpox. When their immune system is compromised or in any way overwhelmed, and this can be due to emotional distress as well, it can trigger it off. It can set off your immune system for the shingles virus to emerge. And then when the shingles virus has emerged at least once, it puts you at a much higher risk of forming or developing trigeminal neuralgia at the age of above 65, usually, but you can also get it earlier. Trigeminal neuralgia is nicknamed suicide headaches. It is that bad. It is literally, and I can tell you, as someone who has some forms of, I have a mild neuralgia that occasionally kicks in, which is unpleasant. It feels like someone has shoved a hot poker through your face. And it's like kind of gone from your face into your head, and it's just you're in a world of pain. You can't really process anything. And it's also, those are some of the people who, some people will push through it and will just wear a face mask despite it. And I admire them, but we're talking, it's very hard for them, but they still do it. But some people with severe trigeminal neuralgia, the fact that like wearing a face mask is like pouring acid on top of an already hot poker thing being shoved in your face. So very graphic, and I will be warning people about this at the beginning of the podcast that it's rough.
Hey, quick question, because what was it called again?
The trigeminal neuralgia.
Yeah, neuralgia. Is that any relation to fibromyalgia? Or just a rhyme?
No, algia just means pain.
Okay.
Yeah. So neuralgia would be nerve pain, which is funny because all pain is via nerves.
Pain.
Yeah. It's pain of nerve origin or affecting the nerves. Then you've got fibromyalgia, which is, it's just like tissue. Fibro just means tissue. So something in your tissue is causing pain. They are narrowing down fibromyalgia further. They're not entirely sure if it's, there's a chunk that are probably autoinflammatory conditions, and there's going to be a chunk that are neuroinflammatory. There's going to be a chunk that's, they're still kind of differentiating between them. There's myalgia, which is simply muscle pain. And when it can be a symptom. There's myalgia. There's arthralgia. Arthralgia is just joints. Arthritis.
Right, because arthritis is joint pain.
Yeah, arthritis is inflammation of the joints. Ah. Arthralgia is joint pain. Okay. So there's little things like that that you can usually hear it in the wording. With a bit of seasoning, you get to know what the wording means.
Mm.
Sometimes they're like, we don't know what's causing this, but you are obviously in pain. Like there's some people who have been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, but they actually have ankylosing spondylitis, which is a change in one of the, so you've got your immune system cells. On the outside of the immune system cells, there's these things that usually present antigens to the body. Like they basically there's cell surface things, and when they're slightly off, the immune system has a tendency to attack the body.
Okay.
And cause some fairly severe pain. So it's a form of autoinflammatory disorder, autoimmune disorder, depending on what the modification is. But ankylosing spondylitis is autoinflammatory, and it is nasty.
Hmm.
And it is very important to stay on top of that one with good physiotherapy and a good rheumatologist, because it can worsen as you get older. Generally, as you hit your mid-30s, it gets pretty rough, and then as you get older than that, it gets even rougher. So it's very important to stay on top of that one. It's usually HLA, I'm going to get this one wrong, it's HLA B26, I think, is the actual most predominant gene that has a variation that causes it, but there's others as well.
You're going to get hostile feedback from all the gene researchers who listen to our podcast.
No, it's okay. That's like, for that kind of thing, check out Healthline. Healthline's great. They're pretty, like, look, you can tell how well an article is researched for Healthline by checking their references and who's written it. And they tend to state, this is not heavily researched. This is a reputable source, or this is not a reputable. They're pretty good. Like, I find Healthline is good for accessible information for folks who might not have a medical or a research background. So it's pretty good.
Speaking of unreliable sources, Catch-22.
Yay! It's a great example of an unreliable source. It's all over the place. Although we have discussed that this is probably by design rather than lack of intent. It's probably quite intentional.
And I still think it's definitely an omnipotent narrator, but I still think we're going through the Assyrian's lens. You know, the way Assyrian sees the world, maybe he's not trying to be an unreliable narrator, but we're definitely not getting everything we'd like from this story.
No, but actually, here's a thing. I was like going, the way I've decided to imagine it for now is like, it's the little guardian angel that's sitting on Yossarian's shoulder, because he seems to survive some situations where he really shouldn't survive. I mean, he ticked off the guy who got Clevenger into trouble, and Clevenger is like a by the book.
Actually, there we go. It is an omnipotent narrator, because Yossarian wasn't in the room for that kangaroo yes. court we went through last
no no
episode. So dear but of God, course, that was an ordeal.
Yeah, I mean, I probably have some feelings regarding legal systems already from my mm-hmm. personal life. So I was like, wow, this is terrible. This is terrible. Yeah.
And I would say it's not too far outside of how a lot of these things work.
At least it doesn't, it feels like it would be something we would see quite often. Yeah. Wouldn't be surprised in these spaces. And I'm sure people who probably cannot express themselves because of their own, they probably have non-disclosure agreements and whatnot, but I would suspect there's a lot of people with military background who go, yeah, that's exactly how it's like. We don't get to speak. Like, you get into trouble for something that you haven't done, and just because they've got it in for you and everyone, like, you just get punished for no reason.
But I've heard those stories plenty of times in the work world, the idea of a manager that's got it out for you or a coworker, or hell, yeah. I've had it plenty of times where for some reason it just seems there's a coworker that wants to make my life miserable. And funny, in every situation that's happened, like, I've just kept doing my job and tried to ignore them as much as possible, and they eventually go away.
It does work, but sometimes you can't keep your nose down because you get accused. I've had friends who've been accused of things, but it turns out some of the things that they were accused of in a workplace setting was literally, one of them was a manager who had it in for them.
Mm.
And then all the workers backed them up and said, no, that's not what this person is. That's not how they are. And the other time was someone who had misheard something. Like, they had heard a word or thought they'd heard a word, and they actually hadn't heard that word. They had asked about something, and friend goes, oh yeah, that's about this, this, and that. Like, read the blurb on the actual item, didn't add to it, just read out what was in front of them on the item, and the person heard something very different. So it was a case of mishearing something
and running with it.
And running with it, because, yeah. So this doesn't mean that people don't do things that are inappropriate and shouldn't face consequences. They should absolutely. But we had, this was one person who already, so the head office were already a little bit on edge because of the manager who was trying to manipulate the situation. And then you had that coworker who was just very young and had difficulty with the person's accent, so to speak.
Ah,
yes. So there was a little, maybe possibly a hint of racism that might have been involved in that one. So, but they apologized after the fact, like, oh, I'm so sorry, I misunderstood. And
well, that's good.
Yeah. But there can be some rough situations where, unfortunately, people don't also double down on when they've made a mistake. They just double down and double down.
And I want to say some people shouldn't have power, but it's a fear even I have with myself. We've talked about it before. If suddenly we got all these sponsorship deals, it's like, and we were able to make a living or a very nice living off this, it's like, would it change how we discuss these books or what books we choose? That, you know, I'm more and more kind of locked in to this idea of power changing people.
I think it's power is one thing, but maybe it's what we call power. Like, so coming to Catch 22, because it's important to stay on topic or try to, or, you know, in this situation with the kangaroo court, you had people who were so desperate for relevance and power or control that the drills became everything. Like
parades,
the parades are just farcical. Like, it's ridiculous. And that was the only way that they could feel like they had something. So their power, it wasn't that the power changed them. It was that they were clinging to this concept of control.
Mm.
That control gave them a sense of power. And the thing that they could control and then they fixated on was the parades. I don't think that power inherently is a bad thing. I think that power is not something that ever lies within. It's never one individual over, or shouldn't be. I mean, the old concept of power, or one concept of power, is like being able to make other people do what I want them to do, right?
Mm.
What if power was being able to encourage others to do what needs to be done?
Or you know, I also think of the internal power, like not compromising your values, the power to say no when you're being persuaded or coerced to do something that you know is
The
wrong.
power of integrity. And it may not mean that you get to have your way, but it may, and you might lose your job for saying
Yep.
no.
There are definitely consequences
Yeah,
for integrity.
power should not be disconnected from consequence, but it isn't the same as consequence, if that makes sense. So you have power to make decisions. You can't necessarily always control the
Well,
outcomes.
you know, it's become a cliche line, but there's a lot of truth that the Uncle Ben in the Spider-Man film, Steve, with great
Yes.
power comes great responsibility. Because if you
Yep.
have the ability to wield power, yeah, you've got to be careful how you wield it, who you wield against, or why you wield it.
Yep. So power requires, if it isn't balanced out with accountability, with responsibility, with integrity, with all those qualities that we need, you end up with said kangaroo court and people showing their egos and their fragile, tenuous grasp on control, which is all they're after.
Yeah, you
Yeah.
know, on the internet, people love to post videos and images and stories about, you know, in the vernacular, we call them Karens now, but like problem customers and
Yes.
shops. And often the sympathy I have felt for those people divorced completely with how awful they're being. Like, no one deserves what they're offering the world, but I often feel sorry because I'm like, this is the only power you probably have in your life to make someone else
Yeah.
in a position where they can't speak up miserable.
Yes, and that's it's a control issue. It's a control, and I think we've made power dirty simply because we've associated with the abuse thereof. And what if we focused more? I like the way that you're phrasing it. It's the internal power. It's the power you have over your decisions, and you have that choice to make. And sometimes it feels like you don't have a choice, but really, you do. You can
Oh
choose
yeah.
not to do the thing. And
Yes,
if you,
like maybe you don't have a good choice. There are instances in your life where there's no good choice, but you always have a choice. Sometimes it's just the least bad choice you can make.
Or you make a choice where you're like, okay, the consequences of A or the consequences of B. So it might not feel like much power, and it is disempowering if people make decisions. I think the difference is when people start making decisions for you, then okay, you're losing power. That's being disempowered. But when you have the freedom to make a choice,
And accept the consequences for that choice.
Even if the consequences suck, and even if the choices are the choices between one sucky consequence or another sucky consequence, you still have choice. Like, for example, should we become financially able to, if there was some sort of financial way of being supported through this podcast, we have a choice to say, like, what are we willing to modify or change in order for this, like, if there are requirements to change, if we can't mention certain words, if we whatever, what are we willing to compromise? Are we willing to compromise? If not, okay, then we can't monetize. If that makes sense. So it's like we review the decisions as we face them.
And I maybe that's my fear, the fear of compromising, I guess, my own internal power for fame, fortune, you know, the things that we're supposed to be
Yeah,
pursuing.
but at the same time, there's a difference between making a conscious choice, like say, okay, you guys are monetized, just you need to at least once an episode mention the podcast host. Okay. Like, if we acknowledge that that's the trade is being monetized for an advertisement, but we also make it transparent, so we disclose this is a sponsored podcast, sponsored by company XYZ, the newest podcast host with the best flavor. I don't know,
The
but you
best
know,
flavor.
I'm just trying to say it's like these like an ad, but you make it clear and trans. I know that was terrible, but like you have it. You're transparent. You're honest with the audience. You're not compromising your honesty.
Podcast host is tangy.
Yeah,
This one has
tangy.
zest.
Oh God, it's terrible. Why did I say flavor? But yeah, so
One's sour.
yes. This one's confused. But yeah, so we have there's like those are the that would be, for example, to me, I can understand that. I'd accept that because I'd want those who are listening to know that there is a financial trade-off going on behind it. It's like we haven't modified anything else, but we will be honest about that. And even if they look at it and say, oh, you guys are sponsored by XYZ, you can't be relied upon to give an unbiased account of XYZ. Okay, that's fair. But as long as the audience knows. And if that makes us less, you like that's just disclosure of conflict of interest as well. I mean that comes from science as well, and that's fine. And I think that's it's better to disclose a conflict of interest than to pretend there's no possible source of bias or conflict of interest.
Yeah, because then you're lying.
Well, not only are you lying, you are. It is a form of deception, but it's also worse because it's like, but I'm not affected by this. How do you know? You might not be affected, but your audience deserves to know that there is a financial relationship involved, that whether I am conscious of it or not, there may be bias introduced. Yeah, and I think that's the things, like being honest and being accountable and transparent are the keywords here.
Well,
So yeah.
being honest and transparent is we are about a half an hour in,
Whoops.
and I think we need to start reading the book.
Because major, 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 major. Major, 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 major. Yeah, that's it. Four times, four
There's
times.
wait, let me just think a bit. It there may be major revelations in this chapter, and we have to prepare ourselves for them.
Terrible. Terrible.
Okay, look.
I've got the Major General song stuck in my head now. Wait, no, that's it.
Chapter 9, Major, 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 Major. Major, 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 Major had had a difficult time from the start. Like Minifer Cheevy, he had been born too late, exactly 36 hours too late for the physical well-being of his mother, a gentle, ailing woman who, after a full day and a half's agony in the rigors of childbirth, was depleted of all resolve to pursue further the argument over the new child's name. In the hospital corridor, her husband moved ahead with the unsmiling determination of someone who knew what he was about. Major Major's father was a towering, gaunt man in heavy shoes and a black woolen suit. He filled out the birth certificate without faltering, betraying no emotion at all as he handed the completed form to the floor nurse. The nurse took it from him without comment and padded out of sight. He watched her go, wondering what she had on underneath. Back in the ward, he found his wife laying vanquished beneath the blankets like a desiccated old vegetable, wrinkled, dry and white, her enfeebled tissues absolutely still. Her bed was at the very end of the ward, near a cracked window thickened with grime. Rain splashed from a moiling sky, and the day was dreary and cold. In other parts of the hospital, chalky people with aged blue lips were dying on time. The man stood erect beside the bed and gazed down at the woman a long time. "I have named the boy Caleb," he announced to her finally in a soft voice, "in accordance with your wishes." The woman made no answer, and slowly the man smiled. He had planned it all perfectly, for his wife was asleep and would never know that he had lied to her as she lay on her sickbed in the poor ward of the county hospital. From this meager beginning had sprung the ineffectual squadron commander who was now spending the better part of each working day in Pianosa, forging Washington Irving's name to official documents. Major Major forged diligently with his left hand to elude identification, insulated against intrusion by his own undesired authority and camouflaged in his false mustache and dark glasses as an additional safeguard against detection by anyone chancing to peer in through the dowdy celluloid window in which some thief had carved out a slice. In between these two low points of his birth and his success lay 31 dismal years of loneliness and frustration. Major Major had been born too late and too mediocre. Some men are born mediocre, some men achieve mediocrity, and some men have mediocrity thrust
Oh,
upon them.
wow.
With Major Major, it had been all three. Even among men lacking all distinction, he inevitably stood out as a man lacking more distinction than all the rest, and people who met him were always impressed by how unimpressive he was. Major Major had three strikes on him from the beginning. his mother, his father, and Henry Fonda, to whom he bore a sickly resemblance almost from the moment of his birth. Long before he even suspected who Henry Fonda was, he found himself the subject of unflattering comparisons everywhere he went. Total strangers saw fit to deprecate him, with the result that he was stricken early with a guilty fear of people and an obsequious impulse to apologize to society for the fact that he was not Henry Fonda.
Wow. I am sorry. I am not the person I kind of resemble.
It was not an easy task for him to go through life looking something like Henry Fonda, but he never once thought of quitting, having inherited his perseverance from his father, a lanky man with a good sense of humor. Major Major's father was a sober, God-fearing man whose idea of a good joke was to lie about his age. He was a long-limbed farmer, a God-fearing, freedom-loving, law-abiding, rugged individualist who held that federal aid to anyone but farmers was creeping socialism. Wow. He advocated thrift and hard work and disapproved of loose women who turned him down. That one hit me. His specialty was alfalfa, and he made a good thing out of not growing any. The government paid him well for every bushel of alfalfa he did not grow. The more alfalfa he did not grow, the more money the government gave him, and he spent every penny he didn't earn on new land to increase the amount of alfalfa he did not produce. Major Major's father worked without rest at not growing alfalfa. On long winter evenings, he remained indoors and did not mend harness, and he sprang out of bed at the crack of noon every day just to make certain that the chores would not be done. He invested in land wisely and soon was not growing more alfalfa than any other man in the county. Neighbors sought him out for advice on all subjects, for he had made much money and was therefore wise. Ha! As ye sow, so shall ye reap, he counseled one and all, and everyone said, Amen. Major Major's father was an outspoken champion of economy and government, provided it did not interfere with the sacred duty of government to pay farmers as much as they could get for all the alfalfa they produced that no one else wanted, or for not producing any alfalfa at all. He was a proud and independent man who was opposed to unemployment insurance and never hesitated to whine, whimper, wheedle, and extort for as much as he could get from whoever he could. He was a devout man whose pulpit was everywhere.
Wow.
The Lord gave us good farmers, two strong hands, so that we could take as much as we could grab with both of them. He preached with ardor on the courthouse steps or in front of the A&P as he waited for the bad-tempered, gum-chewing young cashier he was after to step outside and give him a nasty look. If the Lord didn't want us to take as much as we could get, he preached, he wouldn't have given us two good hands to take it with, and the others murmured, Amen. Major Major's father had a Calvinist's faith in predestination and could perceive distinctly how everyone's misfortunes but his own were expressions of God's will. He smoked cigarettes and drank whiskey, and he thrived on good wit and stimulating intellectual conversation, particularly his own, when he was lying about his age or telling that good one about God and his wife's difficulties in delivering Major Major. The good one about God and his wife's difficulties had to do with the fact that it had taken God only 6 days to produce the whole world, whereas his wife had spent a full day and a half in labor just to produce Major Major. Oh, God. Yeah. A lesser man might have wavered that day in the hospital corridor. A weaker man might have compromised on such excellent substitutes as drum major, minor major, sergeant major, or C-sharp major. But Major Major's father had waited 14 years for just such an opportunity, and he was not a person to waste it. Major Major's father had a good joke about opportunity. Opportunity only knocks once in this world, he would say. Major Major's father repeated this good joke at every opportunity. Being born with a sickly resemblance to Henry Fonda was the first of a long series of practical jokes of which destiny was to make Major Major the unhappy victim throughout his joyless life. Being born Major 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 was the second. The fact that he had been born Major 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 was a secret only known to his father. Not until Major Major was enrolling in kindergarten was the discovery of his real name made, and then the effects were disastrous. The news killed his mother, who just lost her will to live and wasted away and died, which was just fine with his father, who had decided to marry the bad-tempered girl at the A&P if he had to, and who had not been optimistic about his chances of getting his wife off the land without paying her some money or flogging her. On Major Major himself, the consequences were only slightly less severe. It was a harsh and stunning realization that was forced upon him at so tender an age. The realization that he was not, as he had always been led to believe, Caleb Major, but instead was some total stranger named Major Major Major, about whom he knew absolutely nothing, and about whom nobody else had ever heard before. What playmates he had withdrew from him and never returned, disposed, as they were, to distrust all strangers, especially one who had already deceived them by pretending to be someone they had known for years. Nobody would have anything to do with him. He began to drop things and to trip. He had a shy and hopeful manner in each new contact, but he was always disappointed. Because he needed a friend so desperately, he never found one. He grew awkwardly into a tall, strange, dreamy boy with fragile eyes and a very delicate mouth, whose tentative, groping smile collapsed instantly into hurt disorder at every fresh rebuff. He was polite to his elders, who disliked him. Whatever his elders told him to do, he did. They told him to look before he leaped, and he always looked before he leaped. They told him never to put off until the next day what he could do the day before, and he never did. He was told to honor his father and his mother, and he honored his father and his mother. He was told that he should not kill, and he did not kill, until he got into the army. Then he was told to kill, and he killed. He turned the other cheek on every occasion and always did unto others exactly as he would have had others do unto him. When he gave to charity, his left hand never knew what his right hand was doing. He never once took the name of the Lord his God in vain, committed adultery, or coveted his neighbor's ass. In fact, he loved his neighbor and never even bore false witness against him. Major Major's elders disliked him because he was such a flagrant nonconformist. Since he had nothing better to do, well...
He's a flagrant nonconformist. In other words, he's actually doing all the things he's meant to do and no one else does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's terrible.
And he's probably a reminder that, we're falling behind the expectations we have.
Yeah, no, that's competition as a mindset.
People really dislike it if you live in a way that reminds them of their own deficiencies.
Or their hypocrisies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Since he had nothing better to do well in, he did well in school. At the State University, he took his studies so seriously that he was suspected by the homosexuals of being a communist, and suspected by the communists of being a homosexual. He majored in English history, which was a mistake. "English history?" roared the silver-maned senior senator from his state indignantly. "What's the matter with American history? American history is as good as any history in the world." Major Major switched immediately to American literature, but not before the FBI had opened a file on him. There were 6 people and a Scotch Terrier inhabiting the remote farmhouse Major Major called home, and 5 of them and the Scotch Terrier turned out to be agents from the FBI. Soon, they had enough derogatory information on Major Major to do whatever they wanted with him. The only thing they could find to do with him, however, was take him into the army as a private and make him a major 4 days later so that congressmen with nothing else on their minds could go trotting back and forth through the streets of Washington, D.C., chanting, "Who promoted Major Major? Who promoted Major Major?" Actually, Major Major had been promoted by an IBM machine with a sense of humor almost as keen as his father's. When war broke out, he was still docile and compliant. They told him to enlist, and he enlisted. They told him to apply for aviation cadet training, and he applied for aviation cadet training. And the very next night found himself standing barefoot in icy mud at 3 o'clock in the morning before a tough and belligerent sergeant from the Southwest who told them he could beat hell out of any man in his outfit and was ready to prove it. The recruits in his squadron had all been shaken roughly awake only minutes before by the sergeant's corporals and told to assemble in front of the administration tent. It was still raining on Major Major. They fell into ranks in the civilian clothes they had brought into the army with them 3 days before. Those who had lingered to put shoes and socks on were sent back to their cold, wet, dark tents to remove them, and they were all barefoot in the mud, as the sergeant ran his stony eyes over their faces and told them he could beat hell out of any man in his outfit. No one was inclined to dispute him. Major Major's unexpected promotion to major the next day plunged the belligerent sergeant into a bottomless gloom, for he was no longer able to boast that he could beat hell out of any man in his outfit. He brooded for hours in his tent like Saul, receiving no visitors, while his elite guard of corporals stood discouraged watch outside. At 3 o'clock in the morning, he found his solution, and Major Major and the other recruits were again shaken roughly awake and ordered to assemble barefoot in the dizzy glare at the administration tent, where the sergeant was already waiting, his fists clenched on his hips cockily, so eager to speak that he could hardly wait for them to arrive. "Me and Major Major," he boasted in the same tough, clipped tones of the night before, "can beat hell out of any man in my outfit." The officers on the base took action on the Major Major problem later that same day. How could they cope with a major like Major Major? To demean him personally would be to demean all other officers of equal or lesser rank. To treat him with courtesy, on the other hand, was unthinkable. Fortunately, Major Major had applied for aviation cadet training. Orders transferring him away were sent to the mimeograph room late in the afternoon, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, Major Major was again shaken roughly awake, bidden godspeed by the sergeant, and placed aboard a plane heading west. Lieutenant Shyskov turned white as a sheet when Major Major reported to him in California with bare feet and mud-caked toes. Major Major had taken it for granted that he was being shaken roughly awake again to stand barefoot in the mud and had left his shoes and socks in the tent. The civilian clothing in which he reported for duty to Lieutenant Shyskov was rumpled and dirty. Lieutenant Shyskov, who had not yet made his reputation as a parader, shuddered violently at the picture Major Major would make marching barefoot in his squadron that coming Sunday. "Go to the hospital quickly," he mumbled when he had recovered sufficiently to speak, "and tell them you're sick. Stay there until your allowance for uniforms catches up with you and you have some money to buy some clothes and some shoes. Buy some shoes." "Yes, sir." "I don't think you have to call me sir, sir," Lieutenant Shyskov pointed out. "You outrank me." "Yes, sir. I may outrank you, sir, but you're still my commanding officer." "Yes, sir. That's right," Lieutenant Shyskov agreed. "You may outrank me, sir, but I'm still your commanding officer, so you better do what I tell you, sir, or you'll get in trouble. Go to the hospital and tell them you're sick, sir. Stay there until your uniform allowance catches up with you and you have some money to buy some uniforms." "Yes, sir." "And some shoes, sir. Buy some shoes the first chance you get, sir." "Yes, sir, I will, sir. Thank you, sir."
That's confusing. Oh, dear.
Life in cadet school for Major Major was no different than life had been for him all along. Whoever he was with always wanted him to be with someone else. His instructors gave him preferred treatment at every stage in order to push him along quickly and be rid of him. In almost no time, he had his pilot's wings and found himself overseas, where things began suddenly to improve. All his life, Major Major had longed for but one thing, to be absorbed, and in Pianosa, for a while, he finally was. Rank meant little to the men on combat duty, and relations between officers and enlisted men were relaxed and informal. Men whose names he didn't even know said hi and invited him to go swimming or play basketball. His ripest hours were spent in the day-long basketball games no one gave a damn about winning. Score was never kept, and the number of players might vary from 1 to 35. Major Major had never played basketball or any other game before, but his great bobbing height and rapturous enthusiasm helped make out for his innate clumsiness and lack of experience. Major Major found true happiness there on the lopsided basketball court with the officers and enlisted men who were almost his friends. If there were no winners, there were no losers, and Major Major enjoyed every gamboling moment right up until the day Colonel Cathcart roared up in his jeep after Major Duluth was killed and made it impossible for him ever to enjoy playing basketball there again. "You're the new squadron commander," Colonel Cathcart had shouted rudely across the railroad ditch to him. "But don't think it means anything, because it doesn't. All it means is that you're the new squadron commander." Colonel Cathcart had nursed an implacable grudge against Major Major for a long time. A superfluous major on his rolls meant an untidy table of organization and gave ammunition to the men at 27th Air Force Headquarters, who Colonel Cathcart was positive were his enemies and rivals. Colonel Cathcart had been praying for just some stroke of good luck, like Major Duluth's death. He had been plagued by one extra major. He now had an opening for one major. He appointed Major Major Squadron Commander and roared away in his jeep as abruptly as he had come. For Major Major, it meant the end of the game. His face flushed with discomfort, and he was rooted to the spot in disbelief as the rain clouds gathered above him again. When he turned to his teammates, he encountered a reef of curious, reflective faces, all gazing at him woodenly with morose and inscrutable animosity. He shivered with shame. When the game resumed, it was not good any longer. When he dribbled, no one tried to stop him. When he called for a pass, whoever had the ball passed it, and when he missed the basket, no one raced him for the rebound. The only voice was his own. The next day was the same, and the day after that, he did not come back. Almost on cue, everyone in the squadron stopped talking to him and started staring at him. He walked through life self-consciously with downcast eyes and burning cheeks, the object of contempt, envy, suspicion, resentment, and malicious innuendo everywhere he went. People who had hardly noticed his resemblance to Henry Fonda before now never ceased discussing it. And there were even those who hinted sinisterly that Major Major had been elevated to squadron commander because he resembled Henry Fonda. Captain Black, who had aspired to the position himself, maintained that Major Major really was Henry Fonda, but was too chicken shit to admit it.
Of course.
Major Major floundered bewilderedly from one embarrassing catastrophe to another. Without consulting him, Sergeant Towser had his belongings moved into the roomy trailer Major Duluth had occupied alone, and when Major Major came running breathlessly into the orderly room to report the theft of his things, the young corporal there scared him half out of his wits by leaping to his feet and shouting, "Attention!" the moment he appeared. Major Major snapped to attention with all the rest in the orderly room, wondering what important personage had entered behind him. Minutes passed in rigid silence, and the whole lot of them might have stood there at attention till doomsday if Major Danby had not dropped by from group to congratulate Major Major 20 minutes later and put them all at ease. Major Major fared even more lamentably at the mess hall, where Milo, his face fluttery with smiles, was waiting to usher him proudly to a small table he had set up in front and decorated with an embroidered tablecloth and a nosegay of posies in a pink cut glass vase. Major Major hung back with horror, but he was not bold enough to resist with all the others watching. Even Havermeyer had lifted his head from his plate to gape at him with his heavy, pendulous jaw. Major Major submitted meekly to Milo's tugging and cowered in disgrace at his private table throughout the whole meal. The food was ashes in his mouth, but he swallowed every mouthful rather than risk offending any of the men connected with its preparation. Alone with Milo later, Major Major felt protest stir for the first time and said he would prefer to continue eating with the other officers. Milo told him it wouldn't work. "I don't see what there is to work," Major Major argued. "Nothing ever happened before. You were never the squadron commander before." Major Duluth was the squadron commander, and he always ate at the same table with the rest of the men. "It was different with Major Duluth, sir." "In what way was it different with Major Duluth?" "I wish you wouldn't ask me that, sir," said Milo. "Is it because I look like Henry Fonda?" Major Major mustered the courage to demand. "Some people say you are Henry Fonda," Milo answered. "Well, I'm not Henry Fonda," Major Major exclaimed, in a voice quavering with exasperation. "And I don't look the least bit like him. And even if I do look like Henry Fonda, what difference does that make?" "It doesn't make any difference. That's what I'm trying to tell you, sir. It's just not the same with you as it was with Major Duluth." And it just wasn't the same, for when Major Major, at the next meal, stepped from the food counter to sit with the others at the regular tables, he was frozen in his tracks by the impenetrable wall of antagonism thrown up by their faces and stood petrified with his tray quivering in his hands until Milo glided forward wordlessly to rescue him by leading him tamely to his private table. Major Major gave up after that and always ate at his table alone with his back to the others. He was certain they resented him because he seemed too good to eat with them now that he was squadron commander. There was never any conversation in the mess tent when Major Major was present. He was conscious that other officers tried to avoid eating at the same time, and everyone was greatly relieved when he stopped coming there altogether and began taking his meals in his trailer. Major Major began forging Washington Irving's name to official documents the day after the first CID man showed up to interrogate him about somebody at the hospital who had been doing it and gave him the idea. He had been bored and dissatisfied in his new position. He had been made squadron commander, but had no idea what he was supposed to do as squadron commander, unless all he was supposed to do was forge Washington Irving's name to official documents and listen to the isolated clinks and thumps of Major DeCoverley's horseshoes falling to the ground outside the window of his small office in the rear of the orderly room tent. He was hounded incessantly by an impression of vital duties left unfulfilled, and waited in vain for his responsibilities to overtake him. He seldom went out unless it was absolutely necessary, for he could not get used to being stared at. Occasionally, the monotony was broken by some officer or enlisted man. Sergeant Towser referred to him on some matter that Major Major was unable to cope with, and referred right back to Sergeant Towser for sensible disposition. Whatever he was supposed to get done as squadron commander apparently was getting done without any assistance from him. He grew moody and depressed. At times he thought seriously of going with all his sorrows to see the chaplain, but the chaplain seemed so overburdened with miseries of his own that Major Major shrank from adding to his troubles. Besides, he was not quite sure if chaplains were for squadron commanders. So I think we need to do a part two of this. This is going to be a very long chapter.
Yes. I'm just adding a Rue. Comment. 1 second. Click, click, click.
Thoughts so far.
My thoughts so far is that he's just been called. So he was finally connecting with people and then just gets called squadron leader and has no connection with anyone anymore. Well, and it was literally out of spite, and he has nothing to do as well. So it's not like he's squadron leader and he now has some tasks to do. It's like he's squadron leader and he has nothing to do.
Yeah, it's increased the animosity that everyone feels towards him, which apparently has been, well, it sounds like that's been his entire life. This is really a sad character, because from his name onwards, he has been a giant joke.
Yeah, and I guess part of it is also how he's been treated by his father, I guess, as well, like...
Yeah, that start of the chapter with how his father sees the world was... I laughed a lot at it, but my God, there's so many people that just believe that stuff.
Yeah, it's terrible. Like, it's terrible. And I think that I'm wondering... I wonder why he got promoted.
Well, it said Colonel Cathcart... He hates that the...
Oh, yeah, no, but I meant, why did he get appointed as a major to begin with? And I think... I'm wondering if it was actually an accident because of his name.
Yes. I mean, after he got promoted to major, there was the line about how he sped through cadet training because it seemed everyone just wanted to get rid of him.
Yeah, well, because he would have ranked them all.
There was that funny little exchange with Lieutenant Shizkov where they were both sirring each other.
Yeah, and they don't... And the thing is that we were discussing at the beginning... control. It's all about control and egos, and so they wouldn't have known what to do.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if he got promoted literally because of a typo, because of, like, a glitch. Yeah.
It seems no more ridiculous than anything we've seen so far from this outfit. Yeah, it does.
That's the impression I was getting, like, from the... It's like an IBM machine kind of...
It did mention the IBM machine. Yeah.
Okay, let me just scroll. Sorry, scroll. Scroll. Okay. Yes, Major Major had been promoted by an IBM machine with a sense of humor almost as keen as his father's.
There we go, yep.
So he went through, he applied for the cadet training, goes for training, they try and haze them, and literally was promoted to Major the next day. And they're like, how do we deal with this? And it's just weird. Yeah, I think it was an accident.
Yeah, I did like that little line about how the IBM machine had a keener sense of humor as his father. So this rudimentary computer from the 1940s.
Well, also because his father, remember, his father, what he considered a sense of humor, the best joke.
Was about opportunity. You get
was lying about his age. He thought that was a good joke,
The man that the picture that paints in my head of the type of man he is, plus everything else we learned about him, I'm just like, oh my god.
Yeah, he's terrible.
If he wasn't so insufferable, he'd be pitiable.
Yes, but he's a terrible person. Terrible, terrible person. And so, yes, and then the fact that he found out that his name wasn't actually his name, and then that, yeah. So there would have been some interesting, like, that effect on a person, curious. Yep. So he seems highly socially isolated and just...
What was the line? There are like three types of mediocrity in the world. You're born with it, you come across it, or it's thrust upon you.
Thrust upon you. And he's like all of the above. Mm. He was born mediocre. He's just... Mediocrity was just his thing. But yeah. And it's funny that Henry Fonda line, am I going, really?
Well, this was written in the 60s, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, yes, but I'm just thinking also he's... The fact that he was promoted and there was no reason.
And also that weird thing about, like, the men are talking behind his back, how he might be Henry Fonda, he's just too scared to admit it.
Yeah, it's weird. And then you got Colonel Cathcart, who basically goes, I don't like him, so...
Well, he doesn't like that whole outfit.
He doesn't, but he also, I think, isn't he the one who basically agrees with Hitler?
No, that was another guy.
Captain Black?
Might be Black. Cathcart was the one who was... was he the one that was kind of sniping at General Dreidel? Or is he the underling of the guy sniping at General Dreidel?
Yes, he's the underling of the guy sniping at General Dreidel, I think.
Yeah, actually, just keeping like all the people in my head as we go through this.
It's too many characters. I need a character sheet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was kind of the base of that data set you looked up a couple episodes ago.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's just too many things. It's so many characters. Like, I'm trying to figure out Cathcart. Like, but then you can't look up anything because then you'll get spoilers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. We'll just have to take things as they come, and I'm still of the mind that by the end we'll have the full picture, and we'll probably kind of have a full picture of every character who matters. I'm sure a lot of these are just kind of side sprinklings.
Yes, yes. Although Major feels like he's stuck in the middle of it. Poor guy.
His middle name is Major as well. That's why we got the four majors.
Just why would you do that to your child?
And he was so proud of it, too. Even lying to his wife as she's, like, just out. I imagine she was not only exhausted, but probably got some painkillers or something after the birth. And
yeah, maybe.
And he's like, I named him Caleb. And she's like, okay.
Yes, evil. Evil.
That is a pretty malicious man.
Oh, no, he's terrible.
Because he thinks that's a good joke. To name your kid something like that.
Yeah, well, we know that he's not quite... Yeah, he's not the top
He's paid person. By the government to not grow alfalfa.
Well, he's taking advantage of farmer subsidies, yes.
Which is the only socialism he believes in, because conveniently it's the one he's benefiting from.
Mm. Well,
funny how that works, isn't it?
And then only he, no one, everyone else's misfortunes are because of God's decision, except for anything that's misfortune that happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
I actually know people like that, and it makes me
cringe.
Not many, but not in my immediate social circle. But
they're out there, yeah.
They're out there, and I go, that's, no, no, no. But yes, I'm curious, and I am looking forward to next episode to find out more and more.
Yeah, so far this has been an outlier where the chapter started with the character it's named after, and we've just basically been, well, I guess we got that offshoot of his father, but that's related to him, so.
Oh, there's some.
Because he had to grow up with that man. And also, I think, exclusively with him, because his mother left.
No, mother died.
Oh, that's right. And mother he was died, happy she died because he was going to divorce her, or she was going to leave, or...
Well, he was going to get rid of her either way.
Yeah.
They didn't go into that one into too much detail, but...
A lovely man.
Yes, seems lovely. Seems great.
Okay.
Fantastic. Upright first, citizen. Upstanding citizen. No.
Voice of a generation.
Oh, wow. No. Yes,
Okay,
it's
well, let us wrap up unless you have any other.
no, I can't right now. I'm just like major. Poor guy.
I almost wish you had a little clicker as I was
It's
reading
like
that. That would have
major,
driven our
major,
listeners
major,
insane, though, just like
major, major,
that.
major.
I apologize for that nasty crow in the background who just would not be quiet.
Ah, well, look, it's trying to gather enough friends in order to form a murder. You can't help it.
Yeah, we were. It was trying. Well, Major doesn't have any friends. Let me gather.
Yes, I was feeling sad about it.
Well,
Yes.
the music at the top of the podcast was "Soap Runs" by Rupert Gregson Williams and Harry Gregson Williams. It's from the 2019 adaptation of Catch 22. At the end of the podcast is "I'm the Slime" by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
You can find me on Twitter as Roo McMoo, that's RooMcMoo. And you can find our podcast at SMBSLT Podcast, both on Twitter and on Facebook. And if you add at gmail.com, you get our email.
Yep, please, we'd love to hear your feedback, what you think of the episodes, what you think of the books, if you have any suggestions for future books, we are open to them. And until next time, stay safe and enjoy your reading.
Peace.